Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're going to be exploring Kurdish traditions, looking at a really rich collection of sources you shared, trying to understand their history and how they look today.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. The Kurdish people, they're an ethno-linguistic group indigenous to, well, what's often called Greater Kurdistan, parts of Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria today.
Right.
And their heritage goes back centuries, maybe even millennia. And these traditions, they really give us a window into, you know, their connection to the land, their history, their social structures. It's all there.
And it's such a rich tapestry, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looking at the sources, you see inherited customs, social values, art, practices. But also, it's really important to remember the diversity within Kurdish society.
Absolutely. There are significant regional differences, linguistic ones too. Kurmanji, Sarani, Southern Kurdish, Felawani. And religious diversity as well. You know, a Sunni Muslim majority, but also Alevi, Yazidi, Sufi groups. It's not monolithic at all.
So we'll kind of journey from the pre-20th century, looking at that older way of life, nomadism, agriculture.
Right. And the social side, tribes, lineage, family, that whole complex structure.
Yeah. We'll touch on things like marriage customs, which seem really tied to lineage and maybe some material culture, daily life stuff.
Exactly. And then we'll shift to sort of the contemporary picture. How have things like social structures, life events, those big festivals like Newroz, how have they adapted?
And persisted, right, despite all the modern challenges. Plus arts, music, literature, and we can't forget cuisine and hospitality, which seem key.
Definitely. So the goal, I guess, is to pull out the main threads, see how they've evolved, and really appreciate how significant they are for Kurdish cultural identity across time and, well, across borders, too.
Okay, so thinking about that pre-20th century period,
yeah.
What really defined their socioeconomic life? You mentioned nomadism and agriculture.
Yeah, before the 20th century was largely shaped by those two things, nomadic pastoralism, moving with herds, and settled agriculture.
Was it strictly one or the other?
Not really, no. A lot of communities actually combined livestock herding with farming. It wasn't always a sharp divide.
Okay.
The nomadic lifestyle, though, focusing on sheep and goats, that was really suited to the mountains. It involved these carefully planned seasonal migrations, highlands in summer, lowlands in winter.
Carefully planned.
So not just wandering. What did that involve?
Oh, definitely not just wandering. These were often big movements, you know, whole clans or family groups traveling together along established routes.
Right.
They have specific tents, you know, designed for moving for different weather conditions.
Makes sense.
And of course, this whole lifestyle depended on having access to huge areas of grazing land, which, as some of the sources point out, became a major issue later on, with fixed national borders chopping up those traditional routes.
Yeah, I can see how that would cause problems. And what about the settled communities? What was their daily life like?
Well, they were mainly farmers, growing central crops, things like wheat, barley, lentils.
Exactly. Tobacco was often a really important cash crop, too. And depending on the region, fruits, vegetables, nuts.
Okay.
But even in settled villages, livestock often remained important. Animal husbandry was frequently kind of integrated into the farming practices. It wasn't necessarily an either exploitation.
So always this deep connection to the land, whether moving across it or cultivating it. Now, zooming out a bit, how was traditional society actually structured? You mentioned tribes earlier.
Yeah, the basic structure was very much kinship-based. The tribe, the ashret, that was a primary unit, especially for nomadic and semi-nomadic groups.
Ashret, got it.
Leadership often fell to a sheikh, who was a religious leader or more of a secular chief. And these figures could hold quite a lot of authority.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, even later on, when cities grew and people moved, that tribal identification often still mattered to people. It didn't just disappear.
And below the ashret level, were there other layers?
Oh, yes. Kinship was traced through the male line, patrilineally. So lineages and clans were really important. They provided support, defense networks.
Crucial, I imagine.
Especially for nomadic groups, you know, coordinating movements, managing resources together. But also important in villages, maybe for settling disputes and things like that.
And the family unit itself, what did that look like typically?
The household, called mal or zani sometimes. That was the basic social and economic unit.
Mal or zani.
Traditionally, these were often extended families. You'd have multiple generations living together, usually under the authority of the male head of the household, the Malsi.
So a patriarchal structure.
Generally, yes. And this household worked as a collective, you know, producing things together, consuming together, even social life revolved around it. People often helped each other out with labor. That kind of reciprocal exchange was common.
And the roles within these big families,
no.
Were they clearly divided by gender?
Yes, traditional gender roles were pretty distinct. Women were mainly responsible for domestic tasks, childcare, but also a lot of work outside the immediate home, collecting fuel, fetching water, helping with farm work.
A heavy workload.
Definitely. Men's roles tended to focus more on agriculture, maybe trade, providing for the family beyond those immediate household tasks.
But you mentioned something interesting earlier.
Ah, yes. Some historical accounts suggest that Kurdish women might have actually had a more active role in public life compared to women in some neighboring societies. That's something the sources touch on, worth looking into more.
Interesting nuance. It really paints a picture of a tightly knit society, strong kinship, shared ways of life. Okay, let's move to those life cycle events. Marriage must have been central to holding all this together.
Absolutely central. Marriage in traditional Kurdish society wasn't just about two people. It had huge social, economic, even lineage implications.
So not much room for romance then.
Well, marriages were overwhelmingly arranged by the families. The women might initiate talks, but the men usually finalized the agreement.
Right.
And in some cases, they might even arrange a marriage before the children were even born. That really shows the focus on long-term family alliances.
Wow. That's serious planning. Were there preferences for who you married?
Yes. A very strong preference for marrying within the lineage endogamy, it's called. Keeps the family unit tight, keeps resources within the group.
Makes sense. Strategically?
The ideal match, often, was between a man and his paternal first cousin, his father's brother's daughter, or FBD.
As FBD.
Yeah. A man was often seen as having a kind of first right to marry her. If that wasn't possible, another cousin would be the next best thing.
And this wasn't just social preference.
No, it had real practical implications, like for land ownership, how resources were passed down. It kept things in the family, quite literally.
Fascinating. What other customs surrounded marriage? Bride wealth.
Yes, bride wealth, known as naxt or mar, was absolutely central. A payment from the groom's family to the bride's family.
What form did that take?
It could be cash, gold, livestock. It was specified in the marriage settlement. And interestingly, the price might actually be lower for those preferred cousin marriages.
Ah, an incentive maybe?
Perhaps. And failure to pay or even just not supporting the wife properly later on could actually be grounds for divorce under some customary laws.
Really? Okay.
There are other things too, like a gift called Caleb or Serdan, sometimes called milk money, given to the bride's mother.
Milk money?
Yeah. And another practice was direct exchange marriage, pagerherk, where two families basically swapped daughters as brides. That often meant no bride price was needed.
A direct trade?
Pretty much.
And the wedding itself, what was that like?
Traditionally, it involved formally fetching the bride to the groom's home, and the celebrations could go on for days. Lots of music, traditional dancing, huge feasts.
Sounds lively.
Definitely. Afterwards, the bride would usually move to her husband's village or family compound.
And what about after marriage if his spouse died?
There were practices like levirate a widow marrying her deceased husband's brother and sorit a widower marrying his deceased wife's sister, often with a reduced bride price.
Why was that done?
It was mainly about ensuring the children were cared for and keeping inheritance within the family lineage. Again, protecting the family unit.
It really drives home how marriage was less about individuals and more about the wider family, the community structure. Okay, before we go on, oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh.
Rojbosh. Ah, this smells amazing today. Is that a hint of orange blossom I detect? Mm.
It is. And it's got just a touch of sweetness, not bitter at all today.
Right.
Perfect. Let's just take a moment here. Short pause.
Okay, feeling refreshed. Let's get back to our exploration here in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We were talking about marriage. I'm curious about daily life, material culture back then. What were homes like?
Well, for the nomads, the tent was home. Kult Khan, Shadir, or Reshmal, obviously designed to be moved easily.
Right. Settled folk often lived in mudblock huts, sometimes built partly underground for insulation, you know, against heat and cold.
Clever.
These homesteads might also have stables, storage areas. Building materials were usually whatever was local unfinished brick, stone.
And roofs.
They varied, often flat in the plains. In the mountains, you sometimes saw dome-shaped roofs with a central opening, a kolek, for light and air.
Kolek!
And the hearth, the tandoor, embedded in the floor, was crucial for heating, for cooking bread, the staple naan bread, and sometimes it even had ritual significance.
The heart of the home, literally.
Yeah!
And the layout of villages, anything distinctive?
Villages were usually near reliable water sources, naturally.
Makes sense.
And some early accounts, especially about Azerbaijani Kurds, suggest there weren't always dedicated public religious buildings right in the village. Maybe religion was more integrated into home life.
Possible.
Formal marketplaces weren't always a big feature either. People might travel to nearby Armenian or Azerbaijani villages to trade, and graveyards were typically close by.
It gives such a clear image, life really tied to the immediate surroundings, local resources. You also mentioned clothing earlier, that some elements seem really old.
Yes, incredibly so. There are archaeological finds, like carvings from the Achaemenid period, showing figures dressed in clothes that look remarkably similar to modern Kurdish clothing.
Wow, that's incredible continuity.
It suggests some fundamental aspects of dress have persisted for centuries. We can talk more specifics later. The regional variations are fascinating, too. It shows how everyday things reflect both practical needs and really deep cultural roots.
Absolutely. Okay, let's transition now to more contemporary times. How have those traditional social structures held up or changed with everything that's happened in the last century or so?
Well, the 20th and 21st centuries brought huge shifts. That traditional nomadic pastoralist life, it's largely declined.
Why is that?
Several reasons mentioned in the sources. Those fixed national borders we talked about, cutting off migration routes, state policies encouraging settlement, and just general urbanization people moving to cities.
So, less nomadism. What about tribal identity?
It hasn't vanished completely. Tribal identification, the influence of traditional leaders, it's still there. But their actual authority is generally less, especially in cities. Detribalization has been kind of a slow process alongside urbanization.
And the family, that extended family model.
That's evolved significantly, too. You still find traditional extended family households, especially in rural areas.
Imagine.
But urbanization, people working for wages, migration, both internal and international, that's challenged the old economic functions of the extended family.
Right.
So you see more nuclear families now, especially in cities, becoming more economically independent. But even so, the extended family often remains a really important social and cultural anchor, even for Kurds living abroad in the diaspora.
And gender roles. Big changes there too, I imagine.
Yes, quite noticeable changes, largely driven by more access to education, more job opportunities for women, particularly in urban areas.
And you mentioned earlier, Kurdish women perhaps historically had a more public role anyway.
Exactly. And that trend seems to have continued and expanded in many ways, which naturally can shift household dynamics, maybe weaken some of the traditional patriarchal norms.
But it's probably not the same everywhere.
No, definitely not uniform. It varies a lot depending on regions, socioeconomic factors, all sorts of things. It's complex.
So a real mix of continuity and change. What about those big life events like weddings today? How do they show this mix?
Weddings are still incredibly important social events, big celebrations, mixing old traditions with newer adaptations.
How so?
Well, family involvement is still really important, especially in the early stages, like the formal proposal for the bride.
Okay.
And while arranged marriages definitely still happen in some communities, individual choice, negotiation between the couple, that seems to be playing a bigger role now, especially in cities and among the diaspora.
But the option of just running off together, eloping, that still exists too.
Oh, yes. That's still there as a sort of challenge to purely traditional arrangements.
And the celebrations. Still traditional.
Very much so, in many ways. You often still have multi-day parties, lots of traditional Kurdish music, those vibrant group dances like dabgi and dilin.
That good, right.
Traditional clothes are a big feature. Lots of participants wear them. Bright colors, intricate embroidery.
Beautiful.
And the dowry, the mar or naxt, that's still part of the process in many communities, though maybe its form or meaning is shifting a bit.
But there are modern touches, too.
Absolutely. You see Western-style wedding themes creeping in, contemporary fashion choices alongside the traditional clothes, pre-wedding parties, people hiring professional planners and photographers.
So a real blend.
Exactly. It's this fascinating mix of old and new, showing how culture adapts. It reflects how people are thinking about family, individual choice, gender roles, identity, all in this connected world.
It really does sound like a negotiation. What about other life cycle things? Funerals, births?
Well, for the majority Sunni Muslim Kurds, funerals generally follow Islamic customs, specific prayers, burial procedures. Births are happy occasions celebrated within the family and community.
And for boys?
Circumcision is still a significant rite of passage, usually around age 6 to 10.
Is there anything unique there?
Among the Yazidi community, yes. There's a tradition of selecting a tirib, or karifkiniv. This is a respected neighbor who supports the boy during the ceremony and forms a lifelong special bond with him.
A Tarib. Interesting.
And it's worth noting, even something as personal as naming your child has faced political pressure. Some sources highlight restrictions on using Kurdish names in places like Turkey and Syria in the past.
Wow. That really shows how personal traditions can get tangled up in bigger political issues. Okay, let's shift to celebrations. Festivals. Newroz is the big one, right?
Undeniably. Newroz, around March 21st each year, is the most important national holiday for Kurds.
What does it signify?
It's the Kurdish New Year, the start of spring. It symbolizes renewal, freedom, liberation. Its roots are ancient, going back to pre-Islamic Iranian traditions.
And there's a story attached to it.
A very powerful one. Kurdish mythology links it to Kawa the blacksmith. He's the hero who defeated a tyrant king, Dihak, bringing back freedom and spring. Lighting fires on the mountaintops is key to that story.
Kawa the blacksmith. So it's much more than just a spring festival.
Oh, much more. It carries huge historical and mythological weight.
How do people celebrate it today?
Those core symbols are still there. Lighting bonfires is central, whether on mountains or just in public squares.
Yeah.
Huge gatherings, often outdoors in nature. Lots of traditional dancing, like the Dabki and Hell Park. Done with real energy.
Sounds amazing.
People wear their best traditional clothes, often featuring the symbolic Kurdish colors, red, green, and yellow. Special food is shared, music is everywhere.
And you mentioned it became political.
Yes, that's a key point in several sources, especially when celebrating it was suppressed by states. The act of celebrating itself, sometimes defying bans, became an assertion of Kurdish identity, an act of resistance.
So the suppression backfired, in a way.
You could say that. It politicized the festival. Kurdish political movements use Newroz for mobilization, for making demands. Even state attempts to control it or offer alternative versions were mostly resisted.
And where Kurds have more freedom.
There, it's become this massive public celebration of Kurdish culture and identity. It really shows how a cultural tradition can get shaped by politics and become this powerful symbol of survival and aspiration.
A powerful transformation. Are there other big festivals?
Newroz is paramount, but yes, others are observed. The Feast of Sidir Nebi is mentioned as important in some communities.
Okay.
And of course, major Islamic holidays like Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha are widely celebrated by the Muslim majority. Plus, especially in the diaspora, Kurdish communities often organize their own cultural festivals.
To keep traditions alive abroad.
Exactly. Featuring food, music, dance, clothing. These events are vital for maintaining community ties when people are scattered geographically.
It's clear festivals play a huge role in identity and community. Let's talk about arts, music, literature. Music seems particularly important.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Music is deeply loved, really seen as integral to Kurdish culture. Traditional folk music is how history, stories, cultural memory get passed down.
Yeah, the singers.
The dengbej, the traditional bards, are incredibly respected. Masters of storytelling through epic poems, haunting songs.
Dengbej. What about instruments?
A whole range. Wind instruments like the shimshal and zurna, drums like the dahol and daf, string instruments like the tambur, the out, they create that unique Kurdish sound.
Has modern music taken over?
Well, there is modern Kurdish pop music, of course, but traditional music, especially music in the Kurdish language or with political themes, has often faced censorship in some areas, unfortunately.
Right. And dance. Also communal.
Yes, very much so. Integral to social life, especially at weddings and Newroz. Usually performed collectively, people in circles or lines, holding hands, moving together.
Like the Dabki and Hell Park you mentioned.
Exactly. They really symbolize unity and joy. And again, diaspora communities work hard to keep these dance traditions going. It's a connection to home.
A powerful connection. What about literature? Oral and written?
There's a long, rich oral tradition. Epics, folklore, passed down through storytelling and song for generations.
Any famous examples?
The Epic of Mem-Uzin is considered the Kurdish national epic. It was put into its lasting literary form by Emede Zeni back in the 17th century.
Mem-Uzin. Emede Zeni.
Right. Written Kurdish literature developed too. Early poetry between the 15th and 17th centuries, often in Kurmanji, with poets like Zeni. Later, there was a distinct tradition using the Guarani language. Mm. And in the 19th century, the Nali school was really important in establishing Sarani as a major literary language. Prose came along more extensively in the 20th century.
There's multiple literary strands.
Yes. And we shouldn't forget the early written texts found in Yazidi religious scriptures, too.
It's interesting, that strong oral base alongside the written development. What about other arts? Crafts?
Kurdish handicrafts are highly valued. Carpet weaving is probably the most famous.
Kurdish rugs, yes.
They use distinctive patterns, vibrant colors. The symbols woven in are often thought to tell stories or have cultural meaning.
And other crafts?
Intricate embroidery, leatherwork, metalwork too. You can see examples in museums sometimes, a real tangible link to the past.
And more recently?
A Kurdish cinema has emerged, often focusing on Kurdish life, culture, struggles. It's become a powerful, modern artistic voice.
So these arts aren't just decoration. They're about history, identity, community. Now, cuisine, food is always so central.
Mm-hmm.
What's Kurdish food like?
It really reflects that history of farming and herding. Lamb and chicken are staples. Lots of fresh vegetables, rice dishes, dairy products like yogurt.
Any specific dishes?
Oh, yes. Things like hefta, serape, shifta, dolma stuffed vegetables are very popular. Kebabs, too, especially when having guests.
And drinks.
Tea teyse is absolutely fundamental. Drunk all day long, crucial for hospitality. Yogurt drinks are also common, very refreshing.
But food is more than just fuel.
Definitely. It's woven into social customs, especially that strong tradition of hospitality we keep mentioning. Welcoming guests, sharing food, it's all about strengthening bonds.
Sounds delicious and very social.
Okay.
Okay, let's dig a bit deeper into a few specific traditions. Newroz, how exactly did it shift from an ancient rite to this major political symbol?
Well, Newroz always had those themes of renewal, light over darkness, right from its origin, celebrating the spring equinox.
Uh-huh.
And then you add that powerful Kawa, the blacksmith myth, overthrowing a tyrant, liberation. That meaning was already embedded. For
right.
a long time, it was mainly a cultural celebration, bonfires, dancing, feasting. But then in the 20th century, in places like Turkey and Syria, where Kurdish culture faced pressure, celebrating Newroz was often banned or restricted.
By the state.
Exactly. And that repression, maybe unintentionally, politicized it. Just celebrating it, sometimes defying the bans, become a statement, an act of resistance, a visible assertion of being Kurdish.
So the meaning shifted.
It deepened, or perhaps a layer was added. Kurdish political movements then actively used Newroz for mobilization, making political points. State attempts to control or redefine it usually didn't work.
And where celebrations are allowed.
It becomes this huge public affirmation of Kurdish culture, identity, sometimes linked to gains in autonomy. It's a clear case of how politics and state actions can reshape a deep cultural tradition into a symbol of survival and national feeling.
A really striking example. What about weddings? How do they show that tension between tradition and modernity?
Weddings are a great place to see this negotiation happening. Historically, like we said, family arranged, focused on lineage. Key elements were marrying within the lineage, bride wealth, multi-day parties, traditional clothes.
And today?
Many of those things persist. Family involvement is still key at the start. Big celebrations with music and dance are common. Dowries are still exchanged. People definitely still wear traditional clothing.
But things have changed too.
Yes. More individual choice in partners seems common now. People incorporate Western wedding elements, white dresses, sometimes alongside traditional ones, modern music, professional services.
That's driving that change.
Things like globalization, more people living in cities, education, connections with the diaspora, different economic realities. It's forcing a kind of dialogue between honoring the past and embracing the present. It reflects changing ideas about family, individual freedom, gender, identity, in a world that's much more connected.
A constant evolution. And traditional clothing, how does that work as an identity marker now, given those regional variations you mentioned?
That clothing, even with its regional differences, is still a really powerful, visible symbol of Kurdish identity and culture.
Even though people might wear Western clothes daily.
Yes. Its everyday use might be less in cities, but it still holds huge symbolic weight. People wear it proudly for Newroz, for weddings, for cultural festivals, if someone wants to publicly express their Kurdishness.
And in the diaspora, too?
Absolutely. They make a point of showcasing traditional clothing at cultural events. And even if modern fabrics are used sometimes, they often stick carefully to the traditional cuts, designs, the overall look.
Does it carry political meaning, too?
In places where Kurdish identity has been suppressed, yes, wearing traditional dress can definitely be seen as a statement, an act of cultural affirmation, maybe even quiet resistance. It's like a visual language saying, this is who we are, this is our history. Its continued presence really speaks to the resilience of the culture.
Fascinating how much meaning clothes can carry. Lastly, hospitality.
Yeah.
You said it's incredibly persistent. Why have that value endured so strongly?
Hospitality, mevenpreweri, yes, it's just deeply ingrained. Historically, it was so important that leaders often had special guest houses just for travelers.
Wow.
And today, whether in Kurdistan or among Kurds abroad, that tradition of welcoming guests is exceptionally strong. It's considered fundamental to Kurdish ethics, how you should behave.
What does it involve?
Rituals like warm greetings, immediately offering tea, offering food. Hosts really go out of their way to make guests feel comfortable and cared for.
And it hasn't faded like some other traditions.
It seems remarkably resilient, yes. Unlike maybe some other customs that have changed more under external pressures, hospitality remains core. It's a way to build relationships, strengthen the community, express fundamental cultural values. It affirms Kurdish identity, both internally and to outsiders.
A real cornerstone of the culture, then.
It really seems to be. As we kind of wrap up this exploration for the Kurdish Research Audio Archive, it's just so clear these traditions aren't museum pieces. They're alive, dynamic, constantly evolving.
Yeah, they've weathered so much, haven't they? Centuries of change, empires rising and falling, borders being redrawn, the challenges of modern states.
And through it all, these traditions act like threads, connecting Kurds across all those divides, giving a sense of shared history, collective identity.
You see it in Newroz becoming a symbol of resilience, in how wedding customs adapt, the language of clothing, that unwavering hospitality. It all points to this incredible strength and adaptability in the culture.
And the diaspora plays such a huge role now, too, right? Preserving traditions, but also helping them evolve in new contexts through festivals, language classes, just keeping collective memory alive.
It really shows their vitality in a globalized world. Thinking about Kurdish traditions, it really is a compelling look at cultural endurance, isn't it? And that basic human need for belonging, for identity, and how culture, history, and politics all get tangled up together.
Absolutely. We hope this overview, drawing on all those sources, has given everyone listening some valuable insights into just how rich and complex Kurdish culture is.
Thank you for joining us on this journey into the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We really encourage you to keep exploring these topics, maybe pick an area that caught your interest and learn more.